Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Please be seated. And welcome to the afternoon session of the Supreme Court Northern Panel. We are here in the matter of Ferguson versus Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, case number 62357. Mr. Williams, Mr. Eccles, are you ready to proceed? Very well.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Paul Williams of Bailey Kennedy on behalf of Appellant Brian Ferguson. This case is a forfeiture matter where the District Court granted summary judgment for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, which I'll just refer to as Metro, based upon Mr. Ferguson's convictions for crimes that were not related to funds in his bank account. So in essence, the District Court...
Or that were not shown to be related to...
That's correct, Your Honor. We're not shown to be related to the funds in his bank account. So, in essence, the District Court utilized those convictions to lead to the conclusion that the funds in Mr. Ferguson's bank account should be forfeited under the statute. And specifically, what provision they relied upon is NRS 179-1173, subsection 5, which provides that if a conviction is obtained, that the state can utilize that conviction as conclusive evidence of all evidence necessary to sustain the conviction.
So you're suggesting that the denial of your 56F and the fact that, at least according to your pleadings, the Metro presented no evidence of the connection or the criminality related to those funds, that the judge erred and we should just send it back for further processing or further determination of whether or not there are genuine issues of material fact.
That is partially correct, Your Honor. One thing I would point out, though, is that it not only relies upon in our Mr. Ferguson's request for Rules 56F relief, but also that the state never met its initial burden of production under Rule 56E.
So. Mr. Williams, what about this conclusive presumption? Because I totally understand your argument and everything. What troubled me is conclusive presumption. And if it was rebuttable presumption, I think it's really straightforward. If it's conclusive, though, how do we get around that? What's your suggestion?
That's a great question. The issue is what you need to do is you need to look at the statute and what type of evidence can you presume based on that conviction. And if you read the statute, it specifically states facts necessary to sustain the conviction. So the court and the state need to go and look at what facts were necessary to sustain that conviction. And as in detailed in the briefs, those convictions had nothing to do with Mr. Ferguson's funds in his bank account. They're all things for personal property, such as television, computers, things of that nature. They were chattels. They weren't funds in a bank account. So basically, the court in Metro utilized those convictions and tried to apply it and say, okay, you were convicted of these crimes. You have money in a bank account. Therefore, that money in the bank account must be funds from criminal activity. However, the problem, you need some sort of nexus connecting those two things. You can't just assume because someone's convicted and because they have money in a bank account those funds are the proceeds of criminal activity. Mm-hmm. That's the issue here of why they can take the convictions and utilize them just for what that statute expressly says, the facts necessary to sustain that conviction. Here, whether the funds are criminal proceeds or not has nothing to do with whether it was not a finding that the jury had to make in order to sustain those convictions, so they couldn't use that statute properly and say the funds are criminal proceeds. And I think what that goes to is what was Metro's burden of production under 56E? And guided by that is the prism of its burden pursuant to the statute, which is clear and convincing evidence that the property is subject to forfeiture. And that is NRS 179-1173, subsection 3. And here, what type of evidence did Metro adduce that's clear and convincing evidence to show that the funds in Mr. Ferguson's bank account are subject to forfeiture?
Which you're arguing then relieves you of your obligation to show the genuine issue of material fact. If they didn't get the first prong, it doesn't shift to you.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. And as this court stated in Cousy, that burden of production doesn't shift to the non-moving party until the moving party first meets its burden of production to show that there is no genuine issue as to any material fact. And that never occurred here.
Now, Mr. Ferguson, I believe his conviction was a burglary in possession of stolen property was the subject of his convictions.
That's correct, Your Honor, and also a conspiracy count.
Conspiracy, so they're property-related crimes, you know, like that. Was there any offer of proof made by your client to Judge Smith about where this money came from to show it wasn't from this, whatever he's convicted for, the burglary and the stolen property?
But he also had a larceny charge, did he not?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And he was convicted also of larceny, which maybe could tie to the proceeds.
It theoretically could, but if you go back and you look at what those convictions are, what the charges are, none of them relate to the funds in his bank account.
Right.
They're all based on personal property. But going back to this...
Well, could have been, I mean, was there any offer that he didn't sell stolen property or stolen, and then he got from the proceeds, he stuck it in the bank account? I mean, how was that cleared up?
Your Honor, what you look to is Mr. Ferguson's opposition to the motion for summary judgment, which is on the Record Appeal, Volume 3, 663 through 667. And in there, he has a detail. He explains his interest in that property and states that it comes from his employment, from a business he had, gambling winnings, and things of that nature, which are all legitimate sources. And he actually verified that opposition in his affidavit under 56F. So not only does his affidavit support 56F, but he verified the entire opposition.
So your argument is, in essence, first of all, they had the burden of production in the motion, and indeed it was a higher burden than normal because it's through the prism, it's clear and convincing. They didn't make it because the convictions prove guilt of the crimes, but the crimes don't tie to the property. But then even if... your client had an obligation to say or do something, he attested that it came by these money in the bank account by other means, and that's enough for a genuine issue of material fact.
Yes, Your Honor. I think
even if you didn't have to do the summary judgment burden issue.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that would be enough to create a genuine issue of material fact, but we don't get there in the first place because Metro never met its burden.
Although this issue might be premature, but what would happen if there was some sort of commingling? What if the evidence showed that 1,000 of the 125 was from proceeds from the crimes in question. The rest of it was his own in gambling winnings or whatever. Does that contaminate the total proceeds where everything could be seized? Or how does that work?
That's a great question, Your Honor. I think what could happen is the forfeiture statute is a civil proceeding, and it expressly incorporates the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure. So I think on remand, Metro could issue subpoenas to the bank and get all the bank records and try to make a determination of those facts of what's legitimate, and theoretically if there aren't parts legitimate, and obviously the contention is that they're all legitimate, but Metro could use tools of civil procedure to try to ferret that out.
But how does that work under the statute? It does. I don't think you've answered the question. Does any percentage, any portion of what is in the bank account taint it for all purposes?
Understood. And I think what we can look to actually is one of the cases that cited by Metro in their answering brief is a federal case, and what the case specifically talks about how you make that determination. That's U.S. versus Simmons. It's from the Eighth Circuit, and actually goes through. It's a RICO case, mm-hmm. And they talk about how you basically have to do an accounting to try to figure that out. And it's a very lengthy discussion to say, how could you ferret those issues out? And I think there is a process that could be utilized to say, just because part of it is subject to forfeiture, that doesn't make the rest of it forbidden fruit.
Is that what the case says?
The case doesn't expressly says that, but it goes through an analysis stating that you have to.
I get the tracing. I get all of that. I guess our question really was, do we have an answer to that question of if we find that, you know, one portion of it, some percentage of it is traceable to criminal activity, or criminal proceeds, if you will, then what happens to the rest of it? We don't get there yet.
We don't get there yet, Your Honor. And that would have to be decided if there is any connection at all to prove that there's even one scintilla of that money that is subject to forfeiture, which the state hasn't proved. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there's any further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Eccles. I guess we're all, I will speak for my colleagues by asking you the question, what evidence have you presented to the court below that connects the dollars and cents in the bank account that relates to criminal activity or the proceedings from a criminal act, felony that is?
Thank you, Your Honor. As I was looking over the record in preparation for this argument, there's on page 25 to 27 of our answering brief, we listed, I think there's about six or seven items, but I want to highlight a couple of those. This is from our supplemental appendix, page 98. This is the testimony of Tanya Trevarthan, who was Tanya Trevarthan. She was one of the co-conspirators who turned on the other three.
And it's what page?
Page 98 of our supplemental appendix. And what she's testifying to here is that the mode of operation for this criminal conspiracy was to rob these businesses on the weekend.
Was this presented in your summary judgment motion?
This was looked at by Judge Smith after the fact, because what he did is we filed our motion for summary judgment. There was an appeal on, I think it was the order lifting the stay of this entire case. And so Judge Smith heard the motion for summary judgment, the oppositions, but he didn't rule on them. And he says, well, I think I'm divested of jurisdiction, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go look at the criminal, I think he used the word stuff in the record. And so there is an order from this court of November of last year that allowed us to file all this, because we had stayed briefing in this court, did a Rule 10C motion and said, Judge Smith, when you said you were going to look at all of the criminal stuff, exactly what was all of that? And we said, here's some of the stuff that we've relied upon, you know, and here's a bunch of other stuff that's included in these cases. Just tell us what you looked at. And so he entered an order and says, well, here's kind of the scope of stuff that I looked at. We presented to this court, and the court said, okay, we'll allow that to come in your supplemental appendix. And so he did look at this before he ruled on it.
But that was not part of your motion for summary judgment, so that would be procedurally quite difficult for us to say was sufficient to shift the burden to Mr. Ferguson, would it not?
Well, I think
it wasn't before the court. It wasn't what he was confronted with and told to oppose in the trial court.
The testimony of Tanya Trevarthan was before the district court, as it was an attachment to the motion for summary judgment. So what Trevarthan talked about in her testimony is she said that the MO was to rob the businesses on the weekend, sell everything by around Wednesday or Thursday to cash out, and then they would start all over the next weekend. There was so much commingling of dollars and property here. There were several storage units. There were two houses where they stored all these stolen items. In the house where Trevarthan and Damian Monroe lived, they had bundles of cash everywhere. They had, and Ferguson stayed there sometimes. He parked his car there. And so they're all living in this house. Trevarthan testified that in the summary judgment motion that she would deposit these funds into her Bank of America account.
But she didn't, her account, not his. Ferguson's.
Right, that's correct. Now, when there were search warrants that were sent after all of this information came out about these defendants, and there were Bank of America receipts found during the search warrant process of Brian Ferguson's Bank of America account. He also had a safe deposit box that had cash in it. There was paper money in there, there were coins, and there were also some other objects that he kept in there.
And so all of that evidence was presented below, because it doesn't, at least isn't consistent with what I thought I read. All of that evidence about his bank account mm-hmm. was part of the motion.
There was the actual motion itself was very scarce, Your Honor. The information about the safe deposit box was in the 10C motion that Judge Smith said that he looked at.
So we're back to what Justice Pickering said, that it would be difficult for us to rely on that.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, there's case law that says if you get a summary judgment motion and it's presented, it's tested the way it was filed.
Mm-hmm.
Because the person who opposes it has the opportunity to meet it on the merits or to say what you've done is not sufficient to shift the burden of production onto me. And my concern with this whole record and what you're talking about is you file a sparse motion for summary judgment, or your client did, and it is opposed in a fairly simple way. But now you want to backfill it with documents from another case file and a 10C production. Wouldn't fairness dictate that the summary judgment be reversed and Mr. Ferguson have the opportunity to oppose that, and all the evidence that you're now saying is sufficient to shift that burden?
Your Honor, if the court reaches that issue, I suppose that it would be fair to allow him to oppose that point for point. And procedurally, it is a strange case, the way that it happened, because of the divestiture issue. And what I say, Your Honor, is if the court reaches that, because there's also the standing issue, which we raise
right
in our
before
answer.
Before you turn to standing, though, let's, for the sake of this dialogue, pretend the 10C stuff is off the table, and
okay.
We're just talking about the summary judgment that was presented.
Okay.
What evidence is there in that presentation that tied Mr. Ferguson's bank account to criminal activity?
I think what we'd have to look at there, Your Honor, is if you look at the conclusive evidence standard, and then you look at the conviction for conspiracy, and we cited
that's a gross misdemeanor.
I'm sorry?
That's a misdemeanor conviction.
Okay. And I don't think the statute, at least the version I was reading, required any felonies. But it just,
okay.
Let me pull my statute out here, Your Honor, so I'm not.
But keep going. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
And we've cited some cases in our brief that talk about when you have a criminal conspiracy, you don't have to have an allocation of funds to each co-conspirator. And that's supported by NRS 179.1161 defines proceeds, and the definition of proceeds in the statute allows for property derived directly or indirectly. And where that proceeds, that definition comes up again in NRS 179.1164, where it talks about property subject to seizure and forfeiture. 1A says any proceeds attributable to the commission or attempted commission of any felony. And that's where the felony is there. But there were there was attempt burglary, there was burglary, and then there was the other convictions was the conspiracy to commit burglary, conspiracy to possess the stolen property. And that's where we link the statute to the indirect is permissible based upon the conclusive establishment of the crimes, the convictions.
What do you say to the case of Shoka versus Sheriff, which was cited by Mr. Ferguson's lawyer? It's a Nevada case, 108 Nevada 89, that seems quite close. I'm not sure it wasn't cited until the reply, so you didn't have it tendered to you. But it seemed to me to be very close. It held that, and I'm reading, because there was no evidence which traced any of the funds in the account to any criminal activity, we cannot conclude that the account was forfeitable as the proceeds of crime. Earlier version of the statute, but one that at that time was preponderance, not clear and convincing. Are you familiar with that case?
I am, Your Honor. I saw that it was pretty heavily cited in the reply.
Yeah, I don't think it was cited in the opening brief, so in fairness, I wanted to hear from you on it.
Certainly, Your Honor. The Shoka case is interesting because it does have that evidentiary standard and would seem to favor Mr. Ferguson. But the difference in Shoka is that it didn't have two separate proceedings. It wasn't a criminal proceeding followed by a civil proceeding. And my reading of the case, and if it's the same version of the statute, is that it relied upon 179.121. And I looked that up in the current version of the statutes, and it doesn't have the conclusive establishment. It was a case that the state tried to prove both criminal conduct and forfeiture in the same proceeding. And I think that's the big distinguishing factor between the Shoka case. In our case, of course, we have the criminal convictions. The civil forfeiture case was filed shortly after, but then stayed pending the outcome of the criminal case.
Anything else you want to add on the conclusive presumption issue?
I guess one thing I'd like to say, Your Honor, is the direct appeal, there was some language in that order that talked about that he had already litigated these issues. And I realized that this was, once again, an order that was not directly presented in the motion for summary judgment. But more from, it kind of wraps together with the conclusive presumption. If he's litigated these issues in the criminal trial, he shouldn't have the chance to relitigate these in the civil case.
Well, do you think the conclusive presumption means that if Mr. Ferguson had any money anywhere, what if he had gotten an inheritance from his parents or something and stuck it in an account? I mean, does that sweep everything up into being eligible for forfeiture?
I think, Your Honor, that goes back to the 1171 argument we had on standing, that if we do cast our net a little bit too broad in forfeiting things that are not subject to the crime, then he would have a duty to come forward and say, okay, I have an entitlement to these funds, which starts out under the standing statute as, you know, just a short statement of I'm entitled to these funds based upon these reasons. And that's really our argument here is when we got to the summary judgment stage, he's providing information that should have been provided at the answer stage. But I do agree, Your Honor, that there has to be some method to control how much stuff is forfeited, and I think the statutes provide for that. A couple of cases we cited in our briefs on standing was the U.S. versus $133,420, a Ninth Circuit case from 2012. And what that case does is it really confirms what our statutes on the standing say, particularly sub 5 and sub 6 of 1171, that the claimant has the burden of establishing standing. And once the claimant establishes standing, it's only then that the law enforcement agency has the burden to identify that the property is subject to forfeiture. There's also the Dobson Street case, a Seventh Circuit case, that says that if there's no claim as to how the funds came into the possession legally of the claimant, that they're not legally a party to the action. And that mirrors our statutes in sub 6 of 1171. And so our argument would be the court doesn't even need to reach the summary judgment issues because of the lack of standing. We also cited the Aplera case from the California Court of Appeal that says standing is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, can be raised at any time, it's not waivable. Let me finish with the 56F issue. Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned this at all in my answering brief, and there was only a paragraph, I think, that said that they didn't raise the 56F issue in their opening brief, and so it's waived. The reply brief went into some of the statements in there about what everything was. The J&B power washing that the claimant is saying that was part of a legitimate business, there's testimony at trial that said that that was code for burglaries.
But why isn't that a question of fact that defeats summary judgment? I mean, to me, you're asking us to say, as a matter of law, you met your burden. Not you personally, but your client. And he says it's a legitimate business. You say it's code. doesn't earn him a nickel of honest wage. But that looks like an issue of fact to me, and this was resolved on summary judgment.
Your Honor, and then, so if it's the court's inclination to overcome the lack of standing issue and to reach the summary judgment issues, I think it would be appropriate to remand and then give him a very limited time to, okay, on 56F, you know, get your 60 or 90 days and gather everything you want. One other problem with this 56F is he says he wants subpoenas.
I'm sorry.
One of the issues in his 56F motion is he says he wants subpoenas issued, but they're all to his own records. Mm. And he had 5 months to produce those.
Thank you, Mr. Eccles.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Williams, looks like you have 5 minutes and 50 seconds in rebuttal.
I want to hear about 10C and the production of documents.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I think your questions hit the nail on the head with respect to 10C. And this is not a case that it is appropriate to go back and try to inject new evidence to justify a summary judgment motion post hoc. The question is, on the face of the motion that was presented before the court, did the burden shift? Did Metro meet its burden of production to shift the burden onto my client? And the response to that is absolutely not. And as you discussed in some of the questions you raised, were what evidence was attached to that motion for summary judgment? And first off, there's no discussion of Mr. Ferguson's bank account anywhere on the attachments to that motion for summary judgment discussing where those funds arise from. And the only discussion of a bank account is on Exhibit 18, which is a transcript from Mr. Monroe's trial, where Ms. Trevarthen testifies regarding her account and Damon Monroe's account, not Mr. Ferguson's account. So I think that's the correct way to analyze the issue of going back in 10C. If anything, it only demonstrates that the Metro recognized there's not enough evidence to back this up and is trying to go in and justify it post hoc, which is not appropriate because you need to look at it from the stance of what was presented to the court and whether or not Metro met its burden.
So you can unequivocally say, as the question was posed, that at the time the motion for summary judgment was presented to the court, there was no evidence presented by Metro that linked criminal proceeds or criminal activity to the bank account at issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. The evidence, again, is a lot of testimony from Mr. Barfin that relates to Mr. Monroe, not to Mr. Ferguson. One other point I want to address is the arguments regarding...
Monroe and Trevarthen were also parties to this same forfeiture proceeding or parallel forfeiture proceedings?
To the same forfeiture proceeding.
So there was overlap on the...
Correct, Your Honor. And one thing, as we're discussing that too, there's a discussion that Mr. Ferguson was living with these individuals, and nothing in the record really establishes that. There is testimony that he sometimes parked his car there, but there's nothing clear in the record to say that he actually lived there.
So the records... doesn't indicate that he was a full-time resident where this cash was found and the stolen property and all that.
Correct. The only thing that I could discern in the record, you'd have to make the implication based upon the fact that he parks his car there, which obviously not sufficient in my mind. Now, one other thing I want to raise really quick is the issue of standing. And admittedly, the statute does say that Mr. Ferguson needs to make a statement of his interest in the property. But we also, in the reply brief, there are numerous cases cited stating that when standing is raised for the first time on appeal and that issue of standing is based upon a pleading deficiency, the appropriate action is to remand it and to allow the person to correct their pleading. And the reasoning of those cases is that this issue could have been raised below, and if it had been raised below, it could have been very easily corrected. And here, you only need to look at Mr. Ferguson's opposition, which, again, is verified, to come to the determination that he could easily inject that same language into his answer. So,
well, he answered, right? It's Exhibit 3 to the motion for summary judgment. When he had...
He was
represented for a while and then not, but...
That is correct, Your Honor. That's
a verified answer, and he denies that it's subject to forfeiture.
That is correct, Your Honor.
As to him, he doesn't take a position on his co-defendants or co-whatever.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that, again, that's a, this is a very technical pleading deficiency that can be easily corrected on remand. And I want to go to one thing, Justice Gibbons, that you asked about, which is what are the limits of how far the state could take a conviction and basically go get money anywhere that belongs to a claimant? And the point is, you have to go back and look at CHACA specifically. It says you need to be able to trace the money that from the criminal activity to the money in the bank account. It doesn't even talk about a connection. It just says you need to be able to trace that money. And the point of that is you don't want the state to be able to basically take every single asset that belongs to a claimant based upon a conviction. There needs to be that nexus proving by clear and convincing evidence that the property is subject to forfeiture.
What do you say to your opposing colleagues' efforts to distinguish CHACA?
CHACA, as you correctly pointed out, was under the standard of preponderance of the evidence. Now, admittedly, it doesn't go.
His point is they don't have an antecedent criminal conviction, and therefore you don't have the conclusive presumptions in play.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it doesn't go through that analysis. And the time the statute didn't contain that, but the point is, if the convictions don't provide the evidence for that connection, CHACA is still good law because the question is what type of evidence is sufficient to prove outside of a conviction. And here, the convictions at issue don't deal with his funding, don't deal with the funds in his bank account. Also, one thing I want to point out, discussing the civil conspiracy claims, one case actually cited by Metro is U.S. versus Corrado, and talking about conspiracies, that case actually says, oh no, you need a nexus between the property forfeited and the violation. And so I just want to point that out. Those cases still say you have to have that nexus. So in summary, the district court's order should be reversed and should be on remand. Remand should be issued and allow the case to proceed forward. Unless there's any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Williams, Mr. Eccles, thank you both for your participation in this argument today. We did want to note that, as you may know, we are the northern panel. Our designation generally is geographic. We do some overflow of southern Nevada cases. We chose to create this slot of argument time to serve both of you in a way that was more efficient for your respective clients, whether you be pro bono or not. And that's why we came to convene here in Las Vegas courtroom instead of in the Carson City courtroom. And we certainly appreciate the pro bono participation because it's an important part of justice. So thank you all. This case will stand submitted.